Hi everyone! Left to our own devices, the conference may be over, but you can still watch the recording at cybellum.com/conference. Tune in to listen to FDA updates from FDA executives themselves, learn about AI in automotive from NVIDIA, the AI leader, and listen to product security leaders from Philips, Honeywell, CISA, and more. Go to cybellum.com/conference and watch the recording for free. See you at the next event!
Hi, this is David.
And this is Shlomi.
And you've tuned into Left to Our Own Devices,
the Product Security Podcast.
Our guest today is Dominique Shelton-Leipzig, a powerhouse attorney in privacy and cybersecurity, who serves as a partner at Mayer Brown, leading the global data innovation team. Dominique, a visionary at the intersection of law and technology, as the co-founder of Nextwork and a key figure in AI governance, her impact extends beyond legal realms. Recognized as a leader and author, her insights guide organizations through the evolving landscape of responsible AI, innovation, and data leadership. Today, we're privileged to host Dominique on Left Your Own Devices, the Product Security Podcast. Dominique, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
So your background is truly impressive. Could you share some insights into your journey that led you to become an attorney and specialist in privacy and cybersecurity?
Yeah. So in terms of becoming an attorney, I was one of those legal nerds like from the get-go. As early as I can remember, I wanted to be an attorney. I think in hindsight, looking through the rearview mirror, that might have been influenced, or probably a lot influenced, by my family. My father went to law school, back to law school when I was really young, about age 4 or 5. My mother's father, my grandfather on the maternal side, was an attorney in her native country, Haiti, and was a Secretary of State there. So law was kind of all around us, multiple uncles and others, and my cousin is a judge. So I think there was just a lot of law around in our household, and that must have been an influence. But in terms of privacy and cyber, you know, looking in the rearview mirror, it seems like everything was planned perfectly, but these are the things that sort of snippets along the way that have all come together and synthesized in a really wonderful moment right now. So my first privacy course was in 1990. I took privacy and American law with Professor Anita Allen, who's now a dean at UPenn Law, and at the time was on loan from Harvard to Georgetown, where I was studying. And this was in 1990, pre-internet. And really the topic just was my favorite. It was my favorite course, hands down, at school. We dealt with the issues of the zone of privacy, and I wrote a paper about the private lives of public politicians. So this was a fascinating area, but again, pre-digital. Fast forward to 1998, when I'd been practicing about 7 years, I started working for a firm that did a lot of work for tech companies like Yahoo and PeopleSoft. It no longer exists, got rolled into Oracle. But again, just working with a number of tech companies from 1998 to 2007. And the big issues they were dealing with were privacy at the time, and ad tech privacy in particular. So that's how this, and then as things have evolved and adding to that, data breaches, and which really started in the mid 2012, 2013, right around the Target breach. That's when I started working with a number of clients on their cyber issues and data breaches and incident response. So that was, you know, again, fascinating journey. And then now we're coming full circle with AI, bringing all of these things together and also having a global international reach.
So you mentioned PeopleSoft. I actually interviewed with Ken Morris once.
Oh my gosh.
A long time ago. And yeah, wow. And then I ended up in a company that was competing with them. So.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Companies that had such a major presence at the time, in that time period in the late 90s.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. Used to have, I guess, because I don't even know the name, but I guess it's before my time.
Yeah, you're the youngster in the group.
I do know Oracle, so that's fine. I know Oracle well. So, Dominique, quite a journey. And as the leader of Mayer Brown's global data innovation team, You've counseled CEOs and board members on smart digital governance. So in the context of product and device security specifically, how crucial is it for companies to integrate robust cyber governance practices? And what challenges do you commonly observe in this area?
So it's absolutely critical. First of all, thank you for that question. And it's absolutely critical in products and services that cyber be taken into account from the absolute get-go, Shlomi. You know, it's amazing how many times companies are surprised by new technology or emerging technology ushering in fresh verticals for cyber attacks. So understanding how these technologies can be used against a company, and certainly AI is a perfect example of that, to look at the opportunity with the technology and what it will unlock, but also thinking about it strategically and defensively as to how could this be abused by the criminals and threat actors. And so that's a constant. The other thing I will say is a big focus of mine in the global data innovation team is speaking at a very high level, making sure that our CEO and board member communities are briefed on the threat landscape and are in a position to exercise the kind of oversight that's really necessary.
Interesting. Very interesting. By the way, do you work with any companies that have embedded systems?
Yes, working with a number of companies that have embedded systems. We also represent a number of tech companies here at the firm. So seeing all sides of using security by design, assuming, you know, that there's threat actors from the ground zero versus those that are outsourcing everything.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a very interesting time right now, especially since the executive order that came out from Joe Biden about a year and a half ago, and the subsequent regulations that have been coming out from the FDA and the European automotive regulations, WP29 and R155. So a lot of the vehicle manufacturers, a lot of the medical device manufacturers, and then we get to control systems in industry. They're really taking a look now because of the, it's actually really incredible to think that an MRI is a connected device, but it is. And if somebody hacks into it, then, you know, big problems.
Exactly. I mean, really the difference between life and death. And especially, I'm thinking a lot these days about national security and how that all relates to everything. But especially when there are tensions in the world, that's where we see is so many more exploits coming through to American-based or US-based companies. And so it's really important. Lots of times companies don't consider themselves to, you know, really be part of the national security ecosystem, and that's more of a governmental thing. But in fact, whenever there are tensions in the world, we see our private companies seeing exploits at scale and supply chain and all of the different layers, all the vendors associated with these connected devices can be verticals for cyber attacks.
Absolutely. And especially those that people wouldn't consider, let's say, to be critical infrastructure. For example, a manufacturing plant that's putting out food and other things, you know, that people need and consumers need on a daily basis. And that's also considered critical infrastructure.
Absolutely.
So given your extensive experience in training professionals in artificial intelligence, privacy, and cyber, what do you believe are the key considerations companies should keep in mind when implementing AI technologies to ensure both innovation, but also responsible data practices?
Yeah, so this is something I've been thinking a lot about. And at this point in time, I've had a chance to train a little over 50,000 professionals right now on these topics. But the thing that I think is so important for the listeners to understand is that especially when we get into generative AI, the technology is at a state where it can do amazing things like early detection of folks who have a predilection for pancreatic cancer. That's one example being worked on right now here in Los Angeles at Cedars-Sinai Hospital. Also, within the first month of ChatGPT-4 being released, some medical researchers put their data into an AI tool and were able to find a correlation and possible treatment for liver cancer. That's amazing. Just one more example of the transformative nature. We are really a nanosecond away from getting to individualized learning, where children and others and adults around the world will be able to learn in exactly the cognitive way, the individualized way that they're best able to absorb information. And just think how elevated education can uplift our entire world. So this is so exciting, this technology. But in order to harness and to get all those insights that I'm talking about, it involves robust data. So I was astounded to see that we are generating globally 2.5 quintillion bytes of data per day. 18 zeros behind that. So you think about this roiling, you know.
I couldn't even say that.
Let alone imagine. Imagine it, yeah.
Exactly. Well, I mean, but when you think about it, it's just like a roiling ocean of potential insights, information, and things that can be synthesized with our generative AI. So that makes it robust, but it also makes it dynamic. And so I think that the biggest thing that is important for CEOs, board members, and those that are implementing these systems to understand is that generative AI models drift more than the predictive machine learning models. You know, in predictive, you know what the results are going to be. There's a finite area of results that are going to come back out of the algorithm. Generative, it's an open-ended situation. So to get really practical, and then I'll talk about how to govern around this, but to get really practical, you can have an AI that, you know, say you're building a customized chatbot on top of a large language model, like one big logistics company did in the UK recently. And this is an actual true story. Mid-January, the CEO wakes up to the brand trending on X, formerly Twitter, and the chatbot that had been working perfectly previously and had been trained on their data and knew what kinds of questions the customers would ask about when their packages were going to be delivered or picked up, et cetera, suddenly started cursing at customers and criticizing the company as being the worst logistics company in the world. And, you know, further stating that the company had fired all the customer service representatives in favor of the chatbot, and the chatbot couldn't answer questions and was useless. This was filmed by the customer and stuck on X. So that's the type of thing, even though it is a low-risk activity to have a chatbot on your logistics website, you can see for brand reasons why it would be helpful to have governance so that you're not having a chatbot curse at, you know, tens of thousands of customers, but the very first time it happens, the company knows about it and can make outreach and get in contact with the one customer that had that experience and then fix the chatbot and get it back on track so that it can give out accurate information. That's a practical example of why this is so important.
You know, it's interesting that from what I heard, now I'm not an expert in AI, but from what I heard, that the AI engine is learning from the inputs it's receiving. So in this case, possibly the people were cursing at the AI bot because maybe they were afraid it would take their job, and it was just learning and feeding back to the customers what it had learned, which is part of the dangers, I guess, of AI engines.
A much scarier and more intelligent version of a parrot repeating what you said, I guess.
Exactly. And what's great is that it, you know, these types of surprises for companies are actually largely avoidable. So what the regulatory AI frameworks that are based off of Europe, but there's, you know, 97 countries and 6 continents with very similar verbiage that's pending. Basically, what they say is that there should be a risk ranking of the AI so that you know when you're dealing with high-risk AI, and there's about 141 examples of high risk. So, you know, we were talking about something low risk here with the chatbot cursing at customers, but just imagine if that was our power grid or a hospital system.
Or an autonomous car with 2 billion lines of code in it, and somebody was telling it that it's driving too slow or it's hitting the brakes too hard or whatever, and who knows what'll happen.
You know, and so, and to get to your point, we can know what will happen with these regulatory frameworks because it really gives humans a lot of control, you know, controlling the data going in, making sure it's accurate. And then, you know, as a third step, after the risk ranking and making sure you've got accurate data going in and accurate data going out at first, they want, as a third step, continuous testing, monitoring, and auditing. Every second of every minute of every day in the background, the AI is testing itself against guardrails that the company puts in. So let's just replay that anecdote I gave you. What if the company, instead of just having nothing in place, had guardrails that say something like, you know, on the low end, we want calls to start with a please or a thank you. And outside of our guardrail is cursing in any language that we do business in and coding that in code, right? So that the AI could recognize it. Things like that won't stop the AI from cursing at the first customer, but it will protect the brand from this getting out of hand because the company could be alerted that the AI has departed from acceptable norms and go in, look at the fourth thing that these regulatory frameworks call for, which is technical data, logging data and metadata to reflect the tests that are continuous testing that's going on. So a human could look at the logging data and metadata, see exactly when the model started to drift. Was it a change in the training data, change in usage, or what is coming in through the internet as far as insights, and then changing the load balances and or doing whatever needs to be done to get the AI back into the guardrails. So it's sort of requiring companies that are invested in protecting their brand to not just let the brand be awash with negative, you know, headlines about chatbots telling off the customers, or worse yet, hallucinations or misidentifications or just plain inaccuracies. We can get on top of that with this governance.
Right. And I think, Shlomi, I think what we were talking about the other day about classifying components of ML and AI and just being able to detect them, because, you know, a lot of the compliance regulations for embedded systems like medical devices or vehicle components and things like that, they require now software bill of materials or hardware bill of materials where you have to tell the regulators that you know exactly what's inside of all of the different components or all of the software, and you have to be able to monitor for vulnerabilities. So now we're looking at classifying components of AI ML and being able to understand the code, being able to understand what are the inputs, what are the outputs, what is the potential. And like you said, you know, what are we going to wrap it up with in order to protect ourselves and, you know, the people using these embedded systems against problems that might arise from using these engines?
Exactly. And so transparency is so key, and that's a big part of these regulatory frameworks, and explainability to assist with what you're talking about, to really be able to understand the embedded systems and know, A, what they do when they're supposed to operate correctly, and then when they might go off the rails and how to fix it. But you really can't get to explainability until you know that your suppliers are also doing the continuous testing, monitoring, and auditing so they can give you an accurate explanation of how the model works.
I'm actually really curious about it, Dominic. What's your perspective on this? Because one of the things that I keep hearing from AI experts is that it's basically the first technology in human history that is capable of creating something new out of nothing, right? So when you talk about guardrails and putting guardrails in place, what do you do for the scenarios you can't even think about, you know, as AI becomes more and more powerful and it thinks of things that we don't even plan for? How do you create those guardrails for something you can't even imagine?
Well, Shlomi, I think we're, you know, that's an issue for much further down the road. But let's just take the example that I mentioned. I'll give you a couple examples. So the example of the chatbot telling off customers, right? Before the chatbot would replace customer service, there's somebody in the company that was training customer service representatives about how they want to represent the company, how the calls are supposed to go. So all we're saying is, and what the governments are saying with this, you know, legislative frameworks all around the world, is that same information that you would give to an individual, that you would give the benefit of that to the AI so that they would have the same information in terms of guardrails that has to be not described in human language, but actually in code dropped in with ranges and, you know, the curse words, zeros and sevens and so forth, so that the AI can recognize it. So it really, it's much more, we can titrate on these things because right now what AI is essentially doing is helping with productivity, helping with efficiency and gathering things that humans were doing before. So if we can impute what it is that we're expecting the AI to do, just as we do with humans, that will be at least a first step for controlling the data. And I'll give you an example. I'm going to be doing a big trust summit coming up soon. And there's a speaker who's amazing, who literally is working doctorate at Columbia Medical School and he's a great grant from the government, along with a Nobel laureate. And what they're doing is taking the genomic string and applying AI to it and finding early presentations of generative diseases like ALS and pancreatic cancer and a bunch of other things. And, they cannot afford to have drift to the tune of 27.5%, which exists for healthcare. It has to be right because they're talking about chemotherapies and other things to remove DNA that might actually eventually turn into a generative disease. So they've got to be accurate. All right. And they've found a way to control the data going in and control the data going out and getting great results for people. So I think we all need to take a page from that control and not lose sight of the reins.
Right. That's a great example.
It is. And it's such an optimistic outlook on AI that I don't think is talked about enough, this control mechanism. So your book, Trust, Responsible AI, Innovation, Privacy, and Data Leadership, touches on various aspects of digital trust. Could you elaborate on the role of trust in the context of cybersecurity and how it intersects with responsible AI implementation?
Yes. So I was reading a statistic, and companies that are trusted are 400% more profitable than those that are not. And we can look at the anecdotes of this. I'm thinking of a couple of companies who have made trust, cyber protections, privacy protections, part of their advertising, part of their sort of known DNA, and they are soaring north of the 3 trillion market cap club, doing great. Other companies, and I can think of one company just right now that I was looking at last week, social media company, again, profit and revenue may not be exactly the goal in that use case, but they are literally ranking one of the lowest in trust, just because it's, and rightly or wrongly, conceived to be filled with misinformation and untrustworthy material and also malicious links and a bunch of other things. And they are now at a zero market cap, literally 0.00. So I think the evidence is all around us that if you trust anything, especially a product that you're going to put your time in, even if you're not paying resources, but if you're going to put your time and interact with the product, if you consider it to be untrustworthy, let's just talk, us here, Dave and Shlomi, you're going to stay away from that, right? And that hurts our whole global economy. AI is supposed to bring, I think McKinsey and Goldman Sachs looked at this, $7 trillion with a T to our global economy in the next 10 years. And put another way, if that $7 trillion were a country and we were talking about gross domestic product instead of what it's going to bring around multiple countries, that would be the third largest country in the world behind the U.S. and China. So this is tremendous benefit. But if we squander it, and we ran into this with cyber and privacy, and I think we have a chance to fix a lot of it through AI, but last year, cyber attacks cost our global economy $6.1 trillion. And in 2022, because of the data privacy misses, and those weren't discussed in the boardroom, we lost $1.4 trillion in market cap on NASDAQ for just one exchange. There's a lot more. So we're seeing that these losses, when we don't pay attention and titrate on these things, can really dwarf the gains we're supposed to get from AI. And then coupled with that, if no one trusts the AI because they're scared of cyber attacks, they're just not going to incorporate and deploy. And we don't want that. So we've got to exercise our control to make these tools exactly what we expect them to be.
Nice. So commercial break. If someone wants to buy your book, Trust Responsible AI, Innovation, Privacy, and Data Leadership, where can they buy it?
It's everywhere books are sold. Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Target. I mean, pretty much everywhere books are sold. And I would love your feedback and the audience's feedback. And let me know if you find it useful to lead with your data.
Great. Okay. So in your Financial Times op-ed, you discussed cross-border transfers and foreshadowed President Biden's executive order on the EU-US data privacy framework. How do you see this framework influencing cybersecurity regulations, especially for companies engaged in global operations?
Yeah, so, this is so important because we've got personal information coming from the EU to the US now what President Biden's executive order in 2022, essentially EU residents have redress rights, Fourth Amendment rights, as it relates to the sharing of their data. Now, we really need to be thoughtful about how we're sharing that data because, you know, it's really anything, any unauthorized access to data is at issue. And so could a European citizen take the position that sharing data with, say, a third party constitutes an, you know, unauthorized exfiltration of data, potentially? Or could an EU citizen take the position that a data breach that involves their data, that it becomes, I guess, advertised on the dark net, if that constitutes a violation of their Fourth Amendment rights, if that somehow happens on a governmental system? So we really need to think about the interrelationship between this safe harbor that we've developed with the privacy framework and looking at the rights that EU citizens now have, which are equivalent to the US citizens.
So one final question, Dominique, that we're really curious about. Can you share an instance from your career on the more personal side that really stands out as the most memorable or significant for you? And what valuable lessons did you take away from that experience?
Gosh, there are a lot of them that have been impactful along the way, starting from just passing the bar. That was, I think, a day of like complete elation. I was so happy.
Following in the family tradition.
Yes, I just remember coming home and dad giving me a big hug. But I think what's going on right now, Shlomi, I'm just so rewarded. I founded a digital trust summit at my alma mater last year. And I went to the university and said, I think we need to do this because our CEO and board community need a day to think about data and really at a very high level attack and roll up our sleeves about how we're going to deal with data leadership. And so I'm excited that we spent the morning on generative AI and the afternoon on privacy and cyber and national security. We're going to do it again, and we're going to be focusing on generative AI the whole day. And it's just fascinating to me after Davos, where the theme at Davos this year was rebuilding trust. The focus of Davos in mid-January was all about artificial intelligence. And the World Economic Forum's Global Risk Report, which every CEO and board member looks at to identify risk, for the very first time, artificial intelligence got included in the top 10 risks. So we're at a crossroads and we're going to workshop that in very short order with double the size of CEOs and board members, representatives of the UN, and we've got four United States senators coming. And so seeing this be the second annual event and the scale and the seriousness with which our leaders are taking their role is very exciting.
All right. What else can we say? Dominic, you sit in the junction of so many important and future-defining areas, cybersecurity and AI and the combination of all of them. So
and the law.
And the law, of course.
Compliance,
I forgot the law.
Regulations, yeah.
So it was a pleasure, a real pleasure having you on the show today. Thank you so much for sharing your experiences and from your knowledge. And thanks again.
Thank you so much, Shlomi. Thank you, David. I really enjoyed today.
Great having you on.
Left to Our Own Devices is brought to you by Cybellum. To learn more, visit cybellum.com.